Deine Utopie.
Hello everybody and welcome back to another series of Empathy is Not a Utopia. And as you hear today, we're speaking English because we have a famous American guest that I'm very happy to introduce. It's Mary Gentile. Hi, Mary.
Hello, how are you, Maria?
I am good. How are you doing?
I'm great.
Good to have you here. I will quickly introduce you to our listeners. So Mary is a renowned author and educator, known for her innovative approaches to business ethics. And that's why we talked to her today, because empathy and business ethics are coming close for us. And we found that piece of academic and that piece of leadership education that we found so interesting that we asked Mary to be a guest for our podcast, because it could enrich a lot the topic that we were opening up in the last series. And maybe to come to what she's doing a bit closer. She's a creator and director of Giving Voice to Values. She was faculty of the Harvard Business School and of the Virginia Darden School of Business. And nowadays she's dedicating her time fully to giving voice to values and to spreading their beauty into the business world and probably also beyond. Maybe to open up my first question to you, what inspired you to write this famous bestseller, Giving Voice to Values?
Well, thank you so much, Maria. It's a pleasure to be here and to share a bit about Giving Voice to Values. Sometimes I refer to it as GVV. So if I happen to do that, you'll know what I'm talking about.
All right.
Giving Voice to Values is an innovative approach, a new approach to values-driven leadership development. And I created it because I was working, as you said, in business schools, Harvard Business School, University of Virginia, Darden School of Business, Babson College. And in my work there, one of my roles was to help to raise issues around values and ethics in business with MBA students, graduate business students. And then, of course, I would be invited to speak in companies as well. And I became disillusioned with the way we tried to teach about those issues and talk about those issues, whether it was in academia or in practice. And the way we tended to talk about it was as if it was entirely a cognitive challenge. So we would give people, you know, thorny ethical dilemmas, business situations, and we would say, what should you do? And then we would give people models of ethical reasoning that come from philosophy. And we would say, okay, apply this philosophy to these business situations and decide what the right thing to do is. And people would debate and discuss, and then would be done, you know. And I really didn't think that was actually empowering anybody to act effectively on ethics, because one of the things that would tend to happen is that, and we know this now from the research, is that people tend to react in a way that they think is possible. And so if you don't think it's possible to act in a certain way, you'll find ways to rationalize and to justify what you think it is possible to do. And you'll even justify it as if it's ethical. You'll make an ethical case for it. And people don't do this intentionally in order to be bad. It's a natural process. It's even an unconscious kind of process. But I really thought, you know, what we're really doing is just reinforcing this automatic response to justify what you think is possible. And so I became disillusioned and discouraged. I thought this isn't really helping people to act. And the other thing that was bothering me is that we only presented ethical issues that were really dilemmas, you know, what we call gray issues, you know. But a lot of the issues that come up in business are pretty clear, you know, it's illegal or it's legal or it's in compliance with regulation or it's not, or it's abusive or it's not. And so we acted as if the only ethical challenges are ones where it's really possible to answer in any different way and just justify it. So I became discouraged with that. And I actually stopped doing this work for a while. But then I had a number of experiences. I can share them with you if you like. But I had a number of experiences, and I also came across some research. This was about 15 years ago, that led me to think that maybe a more effective way to really empower people to act on their values would be to actually give them scenarios, cases, where the person in the case, the main actor, would already have decided what they think the right thing to do is. And what the business people or the students would be practicing is how to enact that. what to say, what to do, how to respond when people push back, when people object to what you're saying. And when I was learning from interviewing, you know, many, many people, gathering many, many stories, is that the kinds of arguments that you encounter when you encounter values conflicts at work are kind of predictable. They're very powerful, but they're not bulletproof. And so it's very hard to respond to them in the moment if you're not prepared. But the idea here was that we were literally going to give people the opportunity to pre-script and to action plan and to rehearse and to coach each other and to develop scenarios where they were actually creating more options for ways that they could act. And so that was the beginning of the idea of giving voice to values. I gathered hundreds of examples. We wrote lots of cases. We, you know, had there's books and there's MOOCs and there's online modules. There's all kinds of materials now and to help people work through this process. But the beginning of the idea was to give people an opportunity to rehearse and practice. And I guess the last thing I'll say about this is that I find a really nice analogy to illustrate what I'm talking about. Is something that happened to me years ago when I first went to work at Harvard Business School. And I had never in my life felt the need to take a self-defense class. I'd been very lucky. But when I went to Harvard Business School, I had this feeling. It wasn't that anyone was going to attack me, but I just felt a little more vulnerable. And so I looked around Boston and there were these courses, right? And one of the courses I took, it was called Model Mugging. And what they would do is they would teach you all the physical moves to defend yourself, you know, fist to bridge of nose and heel to instep and knee to groin. And you'd practice these moves in the air. And the idea was if anyone ever attacks me, now I know what to do. But there was one, this one class was different, this model mugging class. They would still teach you all those moves. But then once you knew them, they brought a gentleman into the room who was wearing a padded suit, sort of like the Michelin man, if you ever remember those advertisements. And they would line us all up and he would attack us. And you could use these moves you'd learned on him because he was protected. And in the beginning, it was kind of ludicrous because you just stood there waiting your turn to get attacked, right? But as the class went on week after week, I might be talking to you over here and he would come and grab me and I would never know when, I would never know what hold he was going to use. But the idea behind it, they told us, was based on this research that comes from kinesthetics, the study of physical movement. And the research is something called specific state muscle memory. And the idea is that if you rehearse something in the same physiological and emotional and cognitive state that you'll be in when you need to use it, that even if you freeze in that moment, your body will remember. And so, you know, it's kind of like the tennis pro will practice her serve over and over before she goes to the tournaments. And then when she's there under all that stress, she just naturally assumes the proper form. And so I'm taking this class, and one day I'm on my back on the floor because I have failed to protect myself from this gentleman. And I was thinking, could you create a kind of moral muscle memory? Could you create a default behavior, a default to voice and action, but not just to speaking up? This is not about whistleblowing or just, you know, telling your boss that he or she is wrong. You know, it's really about a more kind of informed voice. You know, it's more skillful, it's more nuanced, it's more sophisticated. And you're able to do that because you've practiced. And so the idea is that you're creating, now when I'm in this situation where someone asked me to do something and I know that it's wrong, I have more mental models. You know, I've seen many ways to respond to this situation. And so I feel more confident, the emotion comes down, the stress comes down, and you actually are able to tap into more of your abilities. So that's kind of the idea behind this, this idea of rehearsal and practice. It's actually a pretty simple idea, but it's not something that we did.
Totally. And oh, that's so rich. What you're saying, there were so many aspects in. And it's also so good to hear that it's not a theory only. So what I hear from you, it's much more about implementation. Then about
exactly.
Action. Yeah, about action and empowering people to apply. And what I also like very much that it sits on a perception that people do not come in with bad intention as a general modus operandi. It's they just might not be able to do better in that moment. And that's why you talk about that practice that they could implement before they come into that situation to have that mental mastery available and then to maybe act differently.
Yes, exactly. One of the things that this work is based on is some research that the late Greg Dease and Peter Crampton, they worked on ethics and negotiations. Mm-hmm. And they premised this idea that if you're in a organization or in a classroom, depending on your situation, they premised that the participants are kind of like a bell curve. And at one tail end of the bell curve are the individuals who would self-identify as opportunists. And these are the people who would say, I will always try and maximize my material self-interest, my personal self-interest, regardless of values. Now, nobody falls into one of these categories all the time, but this is people who, if they were being honest, would say that's their primary motivation. And at the other tail end of the bell curve are the folks who would say, I will always try and act on my values, even if it's not always easy for me or good for me. What we premise is that the majority of us fall under the bell. I put myself there. And we call them pragmatists. And we define pragmatists as people who would say, I would like to act on my values as long as it doesn't put me at a systematic disadvantage. Now, that's not the same as saying as long as I know I'll succeed. And it's not the same as saying as long as I know I'll never pay a price. It simply means I think I have a shot. Just like in any business situation, you know, we launch a new product, we move into a new market. We don't know that it's going to be successful, but we've done our research and we've, you know, analyzed it and we think we have a good chance. And so what GVV is about, I don't really feel we have the power to change those opportunists. I think some of them will always be with us. But our approach here is to really focus on the pragmatists and the idealists, and to give them the skills and the scripts and the rehearsal, the practice, the confidence and the comfort, the positive examples to be who they already want to be at their best. We're not trying to change people, we're trying to enable them. And then our theory is that if enough of the pragmatists and the idealists become better at this, become more skillful and confident and likely to do this, it changes the water that the opportunists are swimming in. So the calculus that they do to determine what's in their own self-interest has to change, because they can't rely on the same level of silent complicity from everybody else. And so we're not premising that everyone in the organization is a good person, but we're also not premising that everyone in the organization is a bad person. You know, we're really trying to give the majority of us the skills and the confidence to be able to act on our values more effectively.
Yeah, and as you said that, it's a certain calculus that everybody is going through. And you were saying, as long as it doesn't go for your disadvantage, choose your battles. Yeah, that's something.
Yeah, but you have to be careful with that, because people will always think it's at their disadvantage. So, you know, it's kind of, we're trying to reveal to them that actually that's not always true.
Yes, exactly.
But it's only not true. Mm-hmm. It's only not true if you're good at this, if you practice this, if you're skillful at it, you know, because, you know, you can, you know, call out bad behavior, you know, all the time and be very ineffective at it. And you can be retaliated against for doing that. And so the idea here is, how do you do it in a way that's actually going to be able to be heard by the people that you want to influence? And that's what we're trying to do, is we're trying to teach that skill.
Absolutely. And that's what it was, the point I wanted to get to. There's sometimes fear that is kind of hindering us, and the fear is blurry. And the fear might hold a disadvantage that we think could happen or would be there, but it's just not true. I just read recently a study on, they measured in certain environments, a fear of 95% in business environments. 95% of fear is unreal. Because if you then go to the reality with them. And what we do in what I do in my daily job very often is to go to what's the worst thing that can happen.
Can happen.
And people find out they will survive, you know? And that's actually the deepest desire of every human being. So
you
survive. Will survive. Yeah, you will survive. Even if you're screamed at, you will survive. So and typically we hold these fears and then we hold a kind of assumed disadvantage, what might not be true. And that's what the point what I wanted to get to with what you do, probably you unveil that there might be even more advantages for the people speaking up and speaking to their truth of values than the ones that do not speak up because of this kind of perceived disadvantage that could drop out from that.
Yeah, it depends on how they do it. Right. If they do it skillfully, if they do it respectfully, I mean, one of the things that becomes a challenge is people who speak up, but they speak up in a way that in order to hear them, you have to if I'm the person you're speaking up to and you're telling me that I'm, doing the wrong thing, if in order to hear you, I have to stand in this place of humiliation, I'm not going to hear you, And so you have to find a way to communicate it. I remember giving a talk once when there was a woman in the audience and she was sitting in the back. And you know how when you're giving a talk, you can see people's expressions. And as I spoke, her face got redder and she looked really tense. And I thought, oh, dear. And so as soon as I finished my talk and I said, are there any questions? Her hand shot up. And so I with some anxiety, I called on her. And she said, well, I think this is stupid. And I said, okay, can you say a little more? And she said, well, I don't need giving voice to values. She said, I always voice my values. She said, nobody ever listens, but I always voice my values. And so that's kind of the point. It's like, well, if all you want to do is feel righteous, then yes, you don't need GVB. But if you actually want to have an impact that's positive for the organization and for yourself, then, it might be useful to do some of this rehearsal and pre-scripting and to look at how other people have done this successfully. And the other thing is that a lot of times people will hear the name giving voice to values and they'll think it's about whistleblowing or reporting. And, sometimes whistleblowing or reporting are necessary. I know there are extreme situations where that's the only option, but that's usually pretty costly for the person who blows the whistle, but it's also things have gotten to be very costly for the organization by that point, And so part of what GVV is about is actually trying to change the conversation in the organization earlier, before you get to that point where your only option is to report something or blow the whistle on it, and to actually help people have these conversations constructively before they get into that kind of trouble. And so it's really trying to take a step back in the process to enable people.
Sounds, it reminds me a bit of training for a fire alarm or something. So maybe you can give us a bit more insights how you practice. So what are kind of the nuggets of how you educate an organization in this practice before it comes to the point, or maybe to even avoid these points?
Right, right. Well, so we have a number of things that we do. The key pedagogical tool or teaching or training tool is what we call the Giving Voice to Values Thought Experiment. And these are scenarios. It's case-based. They're all based on real situations. When I work in a company, we'll usually identify situations that are relevant in that organization. But there are real situations where somebody is encountering some kinds of values challenge, a values conflict. But instead of ending the case with the person who has to decide, what should I do? We end the case with the main actor has already decided what he or she thinks the right thing to do is. And the question becomes, how do you get it done successfully? And so then we work people through a series of four questions to help them build up a script and an action plan. And so they have to first identify clearly what the values-based position is so that otherwise people revert back to debating, is it really wrong? So we want to get everyone on the same page that this is the issue. We don't want to cook the books, or we don't want to pay this bribe, or we don't want to, whatever the issue is. And then the second question is, what's at risk for all the affected parties. Now, this is not to do a stakeholder analysis because you've already decided what you think the right thing to do is. But what you're trying to understand is what's motivating all the parties, the people that you want to influence, the people who might be affected by the decision, and even yourself. What are the impacts and the risks and the stakes here? And the reason we're doing that is because if I'm trying to convince you not to do something or to do something, if I understand your motivations better, I might be able to craft my arguments to you and my explanations to you in a way that is more respectful and that also addresses what you're concerned about. And then the third question we ask people to do is to think about is, so what are the objections or the pushback? We call them the reasons and rationalizations. What are the reasons and rationalizations you're likely to hear if you try and raise this issue? And we've identified four of them that we hear most often. People will say, well, it's not a big enough deal to worry about. It's not material. Or people will say, it's just standard operating procedure in this industry or in this part of the world, if you're working globally, or in this organization. And the third one we often hear is, well, it might be an issue, but it's above your responsibility. You don't have to worry about it. We'll make the decision. And then the final one we hear a lot is, well, maybe there's something challenging here, but aren't you loyal to the company or to me, your boss, or to your colleague or to your customer? You know, so they'll kind of play on that conflict of interest. So we hear those a lot. They're powerful. There's others as well, but those are the ones we hear most often. So one of the things we've done is we've started to identify ways to unpack each of those and how you might reframe your response in a way that's successful. And then after people have worked through those three questions, the last question is, okay, take everything you've just identified and come up with an action plan and a kind of decision tree of scripts. So if you said this, and then they said that, then what would you say, you know, or who do you need to involve in this? Is this a one-on-one conversation or do you need to build a set of allies? Is this a one-off kind of situation, just one decision, or is this a whole systemic challenge? You're working in an operating context where corruption is rife. And so it's really systemic. It's not just one situation. And so if it's systemic, then you have to think more long-term and you have to think more incrementally. It doesn't mean you don't have to do anything. Systemic challenges only change through individual actions, but you need to be more patient and to think about the process. And so we work them through all of those kinds of questions. And then once they've come up with a script and an action plan, people will be working on this in different groups. We'll bring them together and I'll share mine and you'll share yours and we'll coach each other. And maybe you came up with something I didn't and I came up with something you didn't. And we'll try and build together the best one that we can come up with. And the idea is people are walking out of these situations with a lot more ideas. I always tell people this isn't easy and it's not even always going to be possible, but it's important and we can get better at it. And the way we get better at it is by developing this greater and greater repertoire of approaches to these kinds of challenges. And then the last thing I'll say is that we've actually identified, we call them the seven pillars of giving voice to values, but we gathered all these stories, you know, and we started to identify what were the things that made it easier for people who did this to do it effectively. And so we'll share those. The one that I think maybe is most important to mention right now is the fifth pillar, which we call self-knowledge and alignment. And the idea there is that people often assume that you can only do this if you are maybe kind of assertive, pretty confident, maybe a good debater, maybe a bit of a risk taker. I used to think that. I myself am not a big risk taker. I'm kind of an introvert. And so I really thought maybe I can't do this. But I started in through all the stories I gathered, I started coming across people who did this in lots of different ways that were consistent with their personality. So I remember there was a gentleman I talked to who he was a real estate developer, and he had stood up to some corruption in his industry. And when I asked him why you did that or how you did that, he said, well, I've always been an aggressive kind of person, a risk taker, kind of assertive. And I thought, why not take a risk in the service of something that really matters to me? So I thought, well, okay. But then I talked to this woman who worked in investment banking. She worked in one of the major investment banks in the US. And she told me a story about a friend of hers, someone she'd gone to business school with. She'd known him for 10 years. He worked for one of the competitor large investment banks in New York. And he called her up one day and said he wanted her to share some information that was proprietary to her company, but he wanted her to give it to him so he could use it for his job. And she said no. And he said, "I'm shocked." He said, "I've known you for 10 years. I was sure you would give this to me." And I said, "Is that true?" And she said, "Oh God, yes." She said, "I'm a total people pleaser." She said, "I'll do anything for anyone." And I said, "Well, then why did you say no? How did you say no?" And she said, "Well, I've always been kind of risk averse. I've always been kind of fearful, even. And this seemed like the safer route." And so I thought, well, if I were to tell that real estate developer that he needed to be more cautious, more conservative, he would say, "Well, that's fine, but that's not who I am." And if I were to tell that investment banker that you need to have moral courage, you need to be bold, she'd say, "Well, that's fine, but it's not who I am." But what I found is that you have to define your challenge in a way that plays to your strengths. So just because you're an introvert or just because you're a risk taker doesn't mean you can't do this. You just have to frame it differently so you're playing to your strengths. So, for example, for me, I found as I did this work that I started speaking up more in my own life, and I'm more comfortable asking questions. And so I found that I would start finding really good questions to ask that would help move the conversation along. Other people are better at just coming right out and making the case, So I think that's an important point for people to remember. There's many different ways to do this, and you have to do it in a way that feels that is skillful, plays to your skills and your comfort level. I always tell people, think about times when you have been effective at acting, at persuading people of anything. It doesn't even have to be an ethical issue. When are you successful? When are you most comfortable? And then use that skill.
Yeah, and that what you say is probably quite good to hear for our listeners, because of course it sounds like a huge courageous step to speak up. And yes, you might feel like even if you're trained, and I got the practice before, but you might think you always have to get into a big conflict. It's a conflict that requires assertiveness, as you say, and not everybody feels comfortable with assertiveness. And we all
Then that's
know as
okay.
yes, yeah, exactly. That's okay. And assertiveness is not always the best answer to everything as well. So to understand that there are many ways of doing it, that you will find the authentic way that kind of goes with along with your skills is probably
Exactly,
good to
exactly.
hear. And what I
Yeah.
also heard, what's I think is also quite good to understand, that you kind of in the group work, find a way that makes you comfortable. So you have kind of a guided process, as you described that, through some questions. Then you can think about your own way, your own values, your own way how to do it. So as you said, that their own maybe reasons, their own risks that you feel like you would take, that they will definitely deviate from each other, right? So
Right.
you sit in a room and you hear things from other people that you might not have thought about, or that are not relevant for you personally, and still that could inspire you to think into another direction. So to become a bit more flexible in your style and not to feel like pressed into one corner. So I can imagine when you get out of that room, where I will ask you in a minute, like how could I in practice imagine that? So you get out of
Right.
this room, you have your action plan, you have your script. You have your consolidated kind of script from the whole room. That's what I understood, right? So you have your own one, you have
Right.
the one with the others. You might feel much more empowered because you've thought through and maybe even practiced a couple of different ways.
Exactly.
And then you see like which one might be the most natural one, or maybe according to the situation, the one comes up and feels more natural in that situation. When you maybe sit in a big group versus I'm alone with another person, you might maybe be more assertive for something else what you trained before. It can also depend on the situation, and then your repertoire will be just much broader. And it sounds to me
Exactly.
like this.
Exactly. That's exactly it.
And how can I imagine, really very practically? So you have an organization. I read that you work with McKinsey, for example, that you worked with a lot of huge organizations to implement that. So how can you kind of practically imagine how that works?
Right. So I've worked with a lot of different organizations, and what I try to do is to figure out how do they already do their own training and people development, because you want to work in a way that feels natural to them and builds on what they're used to and what they're skillful at. So I've done it in different ways in different organizations, but I can give you a couple examples. Most recently, for example, I've worked with a couple different organizations. One is KPMG, for example, the consulting and audit firm. And what we did there, it was actually during COVID, during the quarantine, when they approached me, and they had to do, they have, in order to maintain their licenses, the CPAs have to have a certain amount of training every year around a number of different issues, including ethics. But it was COVID, so they had to do everything web-based. And so they approached me and they said, can we introduce GVB as a web-based program? They were introducing some other programs at the same time. I think they had Dan Ariely was talking about some of his research. And so we did one on GVB, and apparently it caught some interest. People found it useful. So we did a follow-up web-based program where we worked with, I think they identified four or five senior leaders, senior partners. And we worked with them to identify a situation that they had earlier in their careers before they were senior partners, where they encountered a values conflict. And we worked with them on helping them tell the story in a way that it wasn't like, oh, I was a good girl or I was a good boy, aren't I great? But rather to tell the story in a way that you could really feel the struggle. That they would talk about how challenging this was for them. And then they would share how they solved it, how they worked through it. And so by telling that story, people start to understand. First of all, they start to believe that those senior leaders actually care about this stuff. And secondly, it was a teaching story because they learned how they solved the issue. And then we followed it up with a scenario that we asked people to work with on their own. And so that seemed to gather some interest. So then when COVID started to end, well, actually even before it ended, they said, we want to build on this. And so they already did a lot of training for their employees. And if you were in the tax department or the audit department or the consulting department, there would be ongoing training. And so what we decided to do was to bring together a cohort of about 20 volunteers, senior partners and managers who were interested in GVB. And we did an online training with them where over a course of about 4 weeks, I think, they came together. I think it was like once a week or once every 2 weeks. And there were three parts. The first part was they were introduced to GVB in some detail, and we worked through some cases with them so they understood what it was. And then the second part is they worked with a partner to identify a scenario that either they themselves had experienced or that they had witnessed in their area of work, whether it was tax or audit or whatever, and to write it up as a GVB style case, so it's somebody knows what's right, but they're not sure how to act on it. And then to write a sort of teaching plan, a solution, how could you act on this? So that was the second part. And then I gave them feedback. And they revised them. And then the third part was they would teach them to each other. And we would wa I would watch them, and some other colleagues would watch them and give them coaching, feedback on their teaching. So by the time they've gone through this program, they would be considered KPMG GVB master facilitators. And then that meant that next time they were doing a training on tax, a professional development training, or on consulting, or on audit, they would drop in a relevant GVB case to tax or audit or consulting, and they bring in one of these master facilitators to lead this discussion. So in this way, it's not like they always had separate ethics trainings. They built it right into the training for that function, which I think makes it even more impactful. And they built that. We ran this cohort. I think we ran three cohorts. We're planning to do another one later this year. And so there's, this growing group of people who are trained in this. And so, people leave the firm, so they have to bring new people in. And they also have established now a whole library of scenarios and teaching plans, that are relevant to KPMG. So that was a, I think, a really interesting and effective way to do this. And some other organizations I'm working with are doing something similar. I'm working with the MasterCard Foundation in Africa, and they're doing something similar, not quite as extensive as KPMG, but something similar. And then other places like McKinsey, you mentioned, McKinsey decided that they wanted to build more attention to values into their leadership development. And so the way McKinsey works is that they use their own senior partners as the faculty for their leadership development. And so they had, I think, about 80 senior partners they had identified globally as trainers for these leadership programs. So they get together every couple of years and sort of, revise and refine what they're doing. And so one year they got together, it was actually in Berlin, and they asked me to come and introduce this group of senior partners to GVV, which I did. And then we had they had identified a couple scenarios that they thought would be relevant for senior partners. And so after they'd heard what GVV was, they broke into small groups and started to try and apply it, right? And it was interesting because they came back after they'd worked on them together, and I said, well, so what was that like? And the most senior guy in the room raised his hand, first of all, and he said, well, I read this scenario and I thought this is kind of dumb. I know what the right answer is. And he said, but then I realized that's not what you were asking me. You weren't asking me what the right thing to do was. You were asking me, how do I convince my senior partner colleague who, I have to be able to work with him? How do I convince him that what he wants to do isn't a good idea? And so they kind of got it that this is different, And so that was sort of interesting to work with them in that way. We've also worked with Lockheed Martin, the defense contractor, and they already had in place an award-winning training program where they use videos, where every year they would identify 8 to 10 sort of current challenges to the firm, and they would turn them into video scenarios. They used to do it to communicate to people what the right answer is. But one year, this was actually over 10 years ago, the person who was running this program reached out to me and she said, I think we want to go beyond just what's the right thing to do, and maybe talk about how do you get it done. And so they started changing their scenarios so that they would actually feature someone who wanted to do the right thing and maybe tried to raise it and wasn't so successful and then tried again. And they started, focusing more on how do you raise it in a way that is successful and appropriate and likely to work. And so they use these videos every year. So every firm, and the way they do it is interesting. They don't have like an outside trainer come in. They have their own CEO will train her reports, and then they will train their reports, and then they cascade it down the organization. So it becomes even more internalized. So there's lots of different ways to do it, but those are just a few examples.
It sounds like it's really impressive to. I could easily listen 2 more hours to you. So honestly,
Well, thank you.
it's really. It sounds like a. It sounds like a successful work. In particular, in times where I'd say in humanity sometimes needs to step back a bit. Because there are so many people on the earth, we've kind of implemented practices that seem like they need to be that way. There is no discussion around businesses have to grow, businesses have to do it that way, and this is the rule of the game. And all of these sentences you said that before, like there's a standard, we've always done it that way, or it sounds so convincing, and sometimes it's also so limiting. And it sounds very refreshing to hear that there's an approach that's not, already dying in it in its beginning. Yeah, because this in the end, you said that before, the impact only happens with the effectiveness of your behavior. So you can have the best intention if you don't get it across.
That's right.
The
That's right.
impact might at least not be visible. It might be visible for yourself. Others might feel it directly in your surrounding, but it won't be really visible in a future environment. So, and that makes it so impressive that it is breaking with some rules, but in an effective, even gentle ways, in some sense.
Yeah. You know what else sort of strikes me about it is I remember doing a program once in Singapore, and it was with a group of financial managers, you know, people who manage the portfolios of wealthy individuals. And so, you know, that's not my field, you know. So I was a little nervous, I know, and also I'm, you know, it's I was in Asia, so things are a little different there. But we had identified some scenarios that were relevant for the context, and I, you know, explained what GVB was, and then I broke them into groups to work on some scenarios. And it was funny because there was one guy in the room, one gentleman in the room, who had been the most challenging in the Q&A, the discussion after my talk, you know, the sort of the most skeptical, you know. But then we put them in the small groups to discuss these scenarios. And so he was very smart, you know, and but he was also skeptical. But because the scenario is post decision making, because we weren't asking him what you would do or whether this is possible, we were asking how could you do this, he came up with the most insightful and clever way to get the right thing done because we were asking him a different question. Now, if we had the same discussion with him where we used traditional ethics scenarios, he probably would have been arguing why you couldn't do it, you know, or that you shouldn't do it. But because you ask a different question, he was empowered to come up with actually a very, you know, clever way of getting the right thing done. So it sometimes helps people who maybe don't want to seem naive, you know, they don't want to seem like, you know, they don't know what the real world is like. And so therefore they're going to argue a more cynical perspective. It's like the research you were citing a minute ago. But instead, when you ask them, but just what if you were going to do the right thing here? How could you get it done? It triggers a different part of their brain, you know, it triggers this more open, creative kind of approach.
So, may I ask you a final personal question on that? I'd be really interested in, you kind of dedicate your full time into it nowadays. There must be a reason. I mean, we heard a lot of things about what could be a reason. And from a personal perspective, what does really fulfill you? So, what are these moments that bring you a spark?
No, that's a great question. I think it sort of operates two things. One thing is just very personally, I was always the kind of person who, you know, I would observe things that I thought were problematic. But because I'm sort of an introvert, I thought, well, I can't do anything about it, you know? And so when I started understanding this, I'm starting to understand that there are ways I can do this, that maybe it may not be going in there and, you know, arguing with someone all the time. It might be just asking a really good question and getting a different conversation going, or, you know, influencing people in a way that I feel I'm more likely to be able to do successfully. So that was very empowering to me. After I started doing this work, I found, not always, but I found that a lot more I was able to speak up and in a constructive way. So that the one thing. And then the other thing is because I just was so discouraged with the way we were teaching ethics, you know? I mean, I just felt like people are walking into these discussions, whether it was in a company or a classroom, and they're just finding ways to reinforce their sense that you can't be ethical, or that being ethical is okay. I mean, that doing the wrong thing is ethical, you know, sort of convincing themselves. And I thought, really, do I want to be part of that? You know, it just doesn't feel constructive. And so this gave me hope that maybe there's a way to approach this that actually can enable people. And people are starting to do some research. There are, especially in the field of accounting, faculty have been doing some research with students and showing good results that this is actually helping students feel more empowered and have more ability, you know, to act ethically, which I think is, you know, also really nice to have that reinforcement. So I guess two kinds of things make it feel worthwhile to me.
Yeah, and I can feel it once you're talking about it. It really comes across. So, Marie, thank you very much for the time you
Thank you,
dedicated to
Maria.
us. It's really a huge honor for me and for my colleagues as well. Yeah, so we're not present in that interview, but yeah, we were really happy to have you and honored that you kind of contribute to our podcast,
Well, thank
really.
you. Thank you. If people want to learn more about it, they should feel free to reach out. There's a website, there's MOOCs, there's online materials, there's all kinds of stuff. So, thank you. I appreciate it, Maria.
Yes, and should read your books, actually.
Yes. Yeah.
And there is definitely a reason why it became a bestseller. So it
Oh,
is,
thank you.
yeah. So I can, yeah, to all of our listeners, yeah. So it's really a huge recommendation.
Thanks.
If you want to spend some time also to reflect on your own behaviors, on find new ways, and get alternatives. So this is really a fantastic literature.
Thank you. I appreciate it.
Mary, thank you very much. And I look forward to meeting you soon.
That'd be great.
And say goodbye. Thank you.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Goodbye to all our listeners. So as always, we're happy to interact with you. So as Mary also said, you can of course kind of reach out to her. You can reach out to us and interact in the podcast and give your comments, give your likes. And and I say goodbye and see you next time. Bye bye. Tschüss.
Empathie ist keine Utopie.